Dr. Sandler commented on the exciting and rapidly emerging database on predictors of response to TKIs in non-small cell lung cancer, and I met with one of the leaders in this field, Dr. Vince Miller, who began our discussion by putting these advances in perspective.
I think the step back, we shouldn't be too hard on ourselves as far as having the perfect test at this point in time. I mean, for two or three decades, we've had nothing. We've given people empiric chemotherapy with no predictors other than a few clinical parameters of who might live the longest, like performance status and weight loss. And even in breast cancer, we know even with a very positive FISH test, your chance of response to Herceptin is, 25 to 35%. So we now have several markers, both clinical, simple things that can be determined in everyone, like smoking history, ethnicity, and pathology, and some things that aren't as esoteric as they sound in the molecular arena that certainly appear to be better predictors of response than any of these things we alluded to in some of the other diseases, either historically in lung cancer or in, say, breast cancer. So in the arena of clinical variables, we've discussed the never smokers, the adenocarcinomas, the Asian ethnicity. I think never smoking history is the most powerful predictor of benefit. One of the issues for me is whether the never smoking group, since that always seems to do better, in trials with EGFR TKIs, whether there's some other group housed in there that doesn't have an EGFR mutation, but that it's driving some of the benefit. Because as you've seen, the limited data we have in some studies, like in the TRIBUTE study, when we looked at the patients with mutations who got erlotinib, there was no difference in how long amongst all the patients who got erlotinib, whether or not you had a mutation. So that one of the questions for me is whether you're just not detecting the mutation in some of the never smokers, or whether there's some other mutations or something else that makes a subset of those who don't have mutations very sensitive to the drug. I think that this year's ASCO was great. And I think that people said, well, it's not a big year for lung. It wasn't a big year for lung in the sense of having a phase 3 trial like Alan Sandler presented last year.
The bevacizumab study.
Right. But it was important in getting some prospective trials of EGFR TKIs in patients known to have mutations. And now we know that the range, we saw four or five trials presented at ASCO this year, where the lowest response rate in prospectively identified patients with mutations was about 65%. And it went up to about 85 or 90% in the best series. So we have a test that has about a 75 or 80% chance of having a response if you have an EGFR sensitivity mutation, the exon 19 deletion or 21-point mutation. That's pretty damn good compared to what we had 2 or 3 years ago and even what's in other commonly studied diseases that are driven by diagnostic testing.
Where are we in terms of the other tissue assays, FISH and IHC for EGFR, KRAS, and how do they compare to the mutations in terms of prediction?
So the FISH and CISH story, I think the data is actually fairly convergent in the sense that we know that these abnormalities, higher gene copy number, tend to be present in patients with mutations, so that 60 or 70% of the higher copy numbers will be in patients with mutations. We know that we don't see the same magnitude of gene amplification that we see in breast cancer. We have 30 or 40 copies of the HER2 gene. You see maybe 6 or 8 or 10 at most in a lung cancer. And I think that what it probably means to me is that even in the patients without a demonstrable mutation, there's probably some relative benefit to having the amplification or polysomy as it speaks to some degree of activation of that signaling pathway in those patients. And in our trial in bronchoalveolar cancer that we presented this year at ASCO, we had, if you took the most extreme examples, if you had patients who had a mutation and high copy number, their response rate was 90% and their median survival was 3 years with erlotinib. And if you took the patients with no EGFR mutation and copy number less than 4, their response rate was 4% and their median survival was only 15 months. Those are pretty powerful predictors for a difference in clinical outcome with two tests.
I wonder, though, I mean, we know that there are patients who do have great responses, who don't have the mutation, who are smokers, the opposite of every other thing we've looked at. And I wonder whether the excitement about these predictors is maybe causing people to be less enthusiastic about trying a TKI or erlotinib in the other patients.
I think even in my practice where we have access to a lot of these tests and patients are very motivated and will undergo biopsies and things, the absence of a mutation or the absence of certain clinical features predictive of benefit doesn't exclude using the drug at some point. It dials up or down your enthusiasm for where it might be used. So if someone comes in who's got a substantial smoking history and they had a squamous cell tumor, then they'll get pemetrexed in the second line setting, and maybe erlotinib in the third or fourth line setting. I think the one thing that you brought up that might be the closest thing to an absolute in this field, and where I think there's more of a consensus, is that the tumors with the KRAS mutations are much less likely to benefit from the EGFR TKIs.
Can you talk about where we are in terms of access to these types of tests for the oncologists in practice?
Well, I think we're close. I know docs have called me and asked, you know, can you do this test? And I say no, because we'd just be overwhelmed if we did everyone's test from the community. But if you, you know, go to the Genzyme website, they'll tell you how to submit your unstained slides or tissue block to them so that they can do the EGFR mutational analysis and get it back to you in about 7 to 10 working days. So probably 2 weeks within reason.
What do we know about quality control with that particular company and assay?
They use a direct sequencing as opposed to our sequencing and some other centers, which are PCR-based. So it's a little less sensitive, which means I think you have to have, it's got about a 85 to 90% chance of detecting the mutation, whereas some of the other tests may be more sensitive. But they do sequence the whole kinase domain, exons 18 to 24 of EGFR. So they may pick up some other mutations that aren't picked up by certain sort of focused sequencing efforts on the two most common sites, the exon 19 and 21.
What are the situations that you think that assay should be done clinically, adjuvant, locally advanced, metastatic?
Well, this is, of course, a moving target. The trials are just being designed. They're just being done. We don't have results yet. If these patients live longer than most in the locally advanced setting, we're going to take that much longer for follow-up. So a lot of what I'm going to offer is my gut. What do I think we're going to prove 5 or 7 years from now? Certainly in the local regional setting where someone has an operable lung cancer, whether or not they get adjuvant chemotherapy, whether that's indicated, I would want to know their EGFR status. And the reason is, you know, that this is never a wonderful prognosis disease. So even in the best setting, you have a 25 or 30% chance of recurrence. And I would want to know if I had an EGFR mutation in that setting, both from the issue of what if you recur, but also for some discussion about the merits of using the drug in the adjuvant setting.
Can you talk more about that? If you're going to use it, how do you integrate it with chemotherapy and how do you discuss it with a patient?
Well, I think that someone, say, with a resected lung cancer, I would give them their adjuvant chemotherapy first if it were indicated and they had the right clinical profile for it to be administered safely and so forth, no contraindications. And then I would explain about the nature of the EGFR mutation, that this drug is particularly effective in the metastatic setting in patients with that mutation. And in most settings, but not all settings in oncology, when something works very well in inducing regressions in the metastatic setting, it is equally or more efficacious in the local regional setting. That's not a foolproof thing, but it's a pretty general trend. For example, with chemotherapy, you know, the regimens that increase the cure rate in the adjuvant setting, their response rate is 20 or 30% in the metastatic setting. And they do increase the proportion of cures. Why would erlotinib not be at least that, if not more effective? And from having treated so many patients with these drugs, I think one of the more powerful things I can say to them that if it were I and I had an EGFR mutation, I would want the drug in the adjuvant setting.
And I guess there's also the issue of treatment if the patient relapses. It's kind of the same model of, you know, getting an ER and HER2 assay in the adjuvant setting in terms of what you're going to do if they recur.
Absolutely. When a lung cancer patient recurs, they don't always have a lesion that's readily amenable to biopsy. It could be a, you know, bone lesion or a brain lesion or multiple brain lesions. So to have at least some idea of what's driving their tumor, I feel like you're a step ahead in the quest for at least disease control.
And certainly almost all patients, certainly most patients with metastatic disease are going to have a pretty small sample available. How much tissue is required? What kind of tissue? And how often is it adequate in the metastatic setting with a needle biopsy, for example?
So I think of the patients who you would see who had recurrent or metastatic disease, probably about a third would have had antecedent surgery, so that if you called Hospital X and they could dig up the slides from their lobectomy 3 years ago, then you'd have, you know, unlimited tissue in essence at your disposal. But generally, you need about 10 to 15 unstained slides from which they scrape the DNA and look for this mutation. So sometimes if what's called a cell block is made from the cytologic specimen, there is adequate tissue in the cell block. Say if someone had a pleural effusion and they spun it down and made a pellet of the cells, there will be enough tissue there. That's about a 50-50 deal. Certainly if one has had surgery, there should be no reason you shouldn't be able to determine the status of EGFR in that patient. Fine needle aspiration is probably a 75% yield. We have not uncommonly now at our center, particularly in the clinical trial venue, switched over to a core biopsy. The risk of pneumothorax appears quite comparable. There's a slightly increased risk of bleeding in the lung, but we think in the coming years that may become a new standard in lung cancer diagnostics.
Let's talk a little bit about the clinical predictors. I want to talk mainly about smoking, but you mentioned Asian. Is that an independent factor aside from smoking history, and how strong is it?
Yeah, it's pretty powerful. Even in individuals, the frequency of the mutation is much higher in Pacific Rim country residents, even if they're smokers. So in the U.S., say in a smoker, the chance of having a EGFR mutation, depending on your smoking history, might be 5%, 7%. In Japan, it might be 15 or 20%. And in the never smokers, of course, in the U.S. and Western world, it's 40 to 50%. In the Far East, it could be as high as 70 to 80%.
Why do you think that is? I mean, when I think, my understanding of it, this is a mutation in the tumor. So why would there be a racial difference?
I think the only, and this is a general explanation, the only general explanation is that there would be some hereditary component to DNA repair that would allow the mutation to occur in the context of some environmental insult, be it a secondhand smoke component, a cooking smoke component, a toxin, et cetera, et cetera. And so on most of these folks, I am not aware of big epi studies being done, but I really think this is just a question just begging to be asked and answered, and I don't think will be as hard to figure out as some other things in the past.
I guess we don't have enough data to look at Asians who've migrated.
That's always a logical thing to do. I think that's sort of just being done.
Let's talk a little bit about smoking status. Can you update where we are in terms of smoking status, particularly the issue of the oligosmokers?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the important things that's come out of this is that there's a new set of variables that need to go into clinical trial design, clinical trial reporting, clinical trial interpretation. And there's a lot of patients, even if it's a trial of a cytotoxic, and if it's a survival trial, patients will get an EGFR TKI in the salvage setting. So these need to be routinely reported, just as you'd see two columns with KPS or weight loss. And what we can do in a single institution study, might be more involved than what can be done in the phase 3 setting, but I think a number of us, including representatives from the big cooperative groups, agreed that subsequent trials in lung cancer, and even if, Avastin trials or people are reporting who was a former smoker, who was a current smoker, whether pack years, and are these things standardized? Are the instruments perfect? No. But I think, as was pointed out, however we're categorizing these folks, those who smoke less, and particularly those who didn't smoke at all, do really well with these drugs. So we must be, where there's smoke, there's fire. We must be pretty close to quantitating or qualifying things in the right way. The issue of smoking, and the most common lung cancer patient we see now is someone who is not smoking, who quit at least a year ago, and more often than not, 15 or 20 years ago. And of those, probably in the U.S., about 10% of patients are never smokers. The figure's higher in other parts of the world. Like in South Korea, it can be 70 or 80% of lung cancer patients are never smokers. And the former smoker who has a modest smoking history, say 15 pack years or less, is probably another 15% of patients. So when you look at the size of the lung cancer pie, and then we're talking about a quarter of patients who have a modest smoking history, that's a real large number of individuals who may require a different therapeutic strategy.
Do you think this is kind of going to be a continuous variable, like the farther away you are from having quit and the less number of years you smoked, it's going to play out in terms of response? Or do you think there's sort of a break-off point?
Well, we did this study, Dr. Pham, PHAM, in the JCO earlier this year, did a very simple study. We looked at all the patients would ever sequence for EGFR mutations and correlated it with their pack year smoking history. And, if you were a never smoker, you had about a 50% chance of an EGFR mutation. If you smoked up to 15 pack years, you were still up at about 25 or 30% chance of an EGFR mutation. After that, when you went to 20 pack years, you dropped about 10%. So there's still a chance, but you do see a fairly rapid drop-off after 15 pack years. And others are starting to see the same thing as they look at that spectrum.
Can you talk about your thoughts now at this moment, as this has been rapidly evolving in the last few years, in terms of what's going on, in terms of why we see this, how the mutation itself sort of physiologically correlates with the fact that there's a greater response to a TKI? What's happening that the mutation makes the patient more sensitive to erlotinib?
Well, So there are studies that actually show that if you take a cell line and engineer in an EGFR mutation, you transform a benign cell into a malignant cell. So these are transforming mutations that stand alone can create and maintain a cancer. So you can have simpler tumors that really may just be primarily driven by that signaling pathway. Now, that's why some of our preliminary data and probably that of others suggest that if you see one of these mutations in someone who smoked, where there may be more genetic aberrations, the duration of response or the magnitude of benefit, even if these individuals do respond, may be somewhat less. And so it makes sense that those are more complex tumors in the background of smoking. So I think these may be simpler tumors genetically that are driven by one or two or three events rather than tobacco-driven cancers where you have 55 carcinogens in tobacco, each with its own molecular signature. So you could really require, you know, a number of therapies to effectively treat that.
What's your approach to first-line therapy in the metastatic setting for non-smokers and, let's say, somebody with a 15-pack year history that quit 30 years ago?
So for a never-smoker, and in the context of us having phase 3 data with bevacizumab, I still am really moved by the experience in the TRIBUTE study, where we looked at, in a prospective subgroup analysis, 64 never-smokers who got erlotinib with chemo and 41 never-smokers who got placebo with chemo. And we saw nearly a 2.5-fold difference in median survival. 10 months for the control group, so not really different than that for the whole study. It's not as if they underperformed. That was right on the median survival for the whole study. And 22.5 months for the group that got the erlotinib with the chemo. Even in the most ambitious phase 2 study from a single institution, I don't think we've ever seen, you know, nearly a 2-year median survival in metastatic lung cancer in untreated patients. So that, and having had a good experience with that regimen now in my patients, I believe that that is clearly a very effective treatment for the majority of these individuals. They're not cured. We don't want to lose sight of, you know, the fact that we have a tremendous amount of work to do, but it is a palpable step forward in their therapy.
So specifically, how would you integrate the chemotherapy in their erlotinib in terms of timing?
Well, in the metastatic setting, I tend to start the chemotherapy with the erlotinib. I try to give it the same way we give it in TRIBUTE, because in the lack of any clear biologic basis otherwise, that's where we got our best clinical result. I think that in that type of population where you have a high frequency of EGFR mutations, when you use erlotinib in that setting, you tend to induce apoptosis in the tumor cells, and therefore you may not have a inhibitory or negative interaction between the chemotherapy and the erlotinib. And that's actually been shown in cell lines.
So how long do you use the chemo and how long do you use the erlotinib?
So I'd give up to 6 cycles of the chemo with the erlotinib, and then I'd put the person on erlotinib maintenance and continue them until progression. And then one of the things we presented this year at ASCO is the question of an individual who's had a great response to erlotinib, then they progress. Should the erlotinib be continued or stopped? And you probably know better than I, this is a raging debate with Herceptin and breast cancer. Our data was fairly provocative that it may be beneficial to continue the erlotinib, that the rate of progression appeared greater off erlotinib than on.
Can you talk a little bit more about the specifics of that report?
Yeah, so we took patients who either had a known EGFR mutation or had been on erlotinib or gefitinib for at least 6 months, i.e. surrogates for good benefit from the drug, and who then had documented progression at some point in their natural history. We got them a CAT scan and a PET scan. We stopped the erlotinib. We did the exact same 2 scans 3 weeks later. We restarted the erlotinib. We repeated the CAT scan and PET scan 3 weeks later. So we had paired data, baseline, off erlotinib, back on erlotinib. And we also had careful correlation of their clinical symptoms. And we were rather impressed by both the worsening symptomatology in that relatively short time period, with 7 out of 10 people feeling worse. And then when resuming the erlotinib, 7 out of 10 either stabilized or felt better than they did when they were off the erlotinib. Also, there was suggestion on the CAT and PET scan, particularly the PET scan, that some of the lesions flared more and then did quiet down when they went back on the TKI. So our general approach would be that, you know, the resistance to erlotinib is probably arising just in a subset of the tumor cell population. If you can still gain something by controlling majority of cells and stopping everything is probably not prudent in that case.
So in the non-smoker, you would start with chemo / erlotinib, continue the erlotinib. Where does Bev fit in?
I think Bev fits in when, you know, in the absence of a clinical trial showing that Bev maintenance would be a great thing, adding it to erlotinib, I think Bev fits in at the time of progression as an option.
What are the other options that you consider at that point?
Well, I think if an individual progressed on erlotinib who'd had a very good result initially, we oftentimes try to rebiopsy these folks to look for the second mutation, the acquired resistance mutation, analogous to what's been found in CML, where they're looking at drugs like dasatinib and GIST tumors. And there are trials that are specifically focusing on that population. But I think our general approach off of protocol would be to continue the EGFR TKI and probably add in either chemotherapy or bevacizumab. No one knows which is better. And the ideal thing is to have a trial for these folks. But in the absence of that, some of these folks can have very good results with chemotherapy added in.
Now, what's your algorithm in the patient, again, who quit 25, 30 years ago, had less than 15-pack years? Same algorithm or different?
That's a tough call. I think that I'm more inclined, if they're bevacizumab eligible, because the likelihood of mutation is less at 15-pack years than it is if one is a never-smoker, to consider adding the bevacizumab to the chemotherapy.
As opposed to erlotinib.
Yeah. And if you look at it, we might have some rough numbers in this. When Dr. Sandler presents the Bev carbotaxol data, he's got a 35% response rate. I know that with carbotaxol and erlotinib in an unselected population or in a 15-pack year smoker, I have about a 20% chance of an EGFR mutation. So my chance of response is probably not significantly higher, and it might be less than if you use the bevacizumab approach.
Do you think chemo is adding anything in the non-smoker? Do you think erlotinib would give the same results? Of course, that you're doing a trial looking at that. Maybe you can talk about the trial.
Yeah, well, we even discussed this amongst ourselves, you know, in a curious and friendly, contentious way. One of my colleagues who's been great in the lab with this stuff and in the clinic, William Pao, thinks that the Tarceva alone may be just as good in that population, or at least in the mutated population. And one of the questions, of course, is whether the mutation population is really just a subset inside the never smokers, or whether there's a group of never smokers without mutations who do somewhat better. I prefer, in the absence of a known mutation, to give chemo with the EGFR TKI to the never smoker. A, that's our best data ever, the 23 months. And B, there may be some patients in there with KRAS or other mutations who might be more likely to garner some benefit from chemo than if they were just treated with the EGFR TKI alone.
Could you talk about some of the current ongoing clinical trials right now that are looking at erlotinib?
So there are a number of fun and exciting studies that are ongoing or planned. One of the studies that we lead in the CALGB is a randomized phase 2 trial. And it's a trial that will compare chemotherapy with erlotinib versus erlotinib alone. And each of those is to be compared to historical controls from Tribute. So we want to see if the erlotinib alone looks as good as, say, the carbotaxol, i.e. could be a surrogate for it in that never-smoking population. Does it look like it's 10 months median survival? And to see if the other group does hold up to that 23 months that we saw for the never-smokers. And the trial is powered to ensure that we'll be able to have a fairly... Everyone has to have adequate tissue for EGFR sequencing. We don't want a lot of dropouts. So in this setting, we're mandating really that the patients have a pathology block. They must have had some sort of prior surgery for their lung cancer, or either at presentation or on recurrence had a metastatic site removed. Because we want to be able to make sure we have enough patients with EGFR mutations to compare whether there's a differential benefit between just EGFR mutated patients versus the oligo smokers at large, and to get a feel for that. Maybe chemo with Tarceva is better in the oligo smokers at large, but Tarceva looks just as good as the combination in the patients with mutations.
What about trials in the adjuvant setting?
So there's a trial that's planned of erlotinib versus placebo in patients who have evidence of EGFR signaling pathway activation. And that trial is an industry-sponsored trial in which we're not planning to participate, but it's basically driven by immunohistochemical or evidence of gene amplification on FISH to attain eligibility.
What are your thoughts about IHC versus FISH in terms of prediction?
I think, well, as you may know, there are some methodologic issues to be worked out. Previously, the DACO cutoff value for some of these interpretation of a test as positive has varied from either 1% of cells having some staining, which is almost every lung cancer, to 10% of cells having some staining. And so that's one methodologic issue. The second is that most tumors will have some degree of EGFR positivity. And in most of the studies that have been done, although IHC may correlate with one or more endpoints, it most commonly has been trumped, or more powerful indicators have been tests like FISH or mutation status. So I don't know that the IHC per se adds much. I think there is a trial in SWOG, which is a trial looking at erlotinib-based combination with chemotherapy that requires the combination of amplification testing and IHC as a surrogate for pathway activation in order to obtain eligibility on that study. But of the two, I think that the amplification slash polysomy story is a more powerful one to predict some benefit from the class of drugs.
Now, does this erlotinib versus placebo adjuvant trial allow for adjuvant chemo?
Yeah, I believe the individuals complete their adjuvant chemotherapy first, and then they're randomized and stratified by smoking status and are eligible based on their molecular profile.
I want to talk a little bit about the new adjuvant trial that's going to look at bevacizumab also, but just to finish out on the TKIs, anything new in terms of the rash, either in terms of management or prediction of response?
For management, I think Roman Perez-Soler presented some data this year on using vitamin K derivatives or analogs for treatment of it that looked fairly promising. I think that the enthusiasm for rash as a predictor of benefit or dosing to rash has waned a little bit. I actually saw a patient the other day who'd been continuously trying to updose their erlotinib until rash and actually developed, you know, profound fatigue and anorexia, got some rash, but didn't have any augmented tumor response. This is actually a lady with a mutation, and she had grafted out all her tumor measurements. She'd had a partial response. She was trying to see if she could make things that much better by getting a more severe rash, and only at Memorial would have all those calculations put in front of us.
I was going to say only in New York City do you see patients like that. Well, maybe not. I don't know, but that's interesting. Getting back to the vitamin K, is that commercially available? Can you get that over the counter?
I'm not sure. I did not. I haven't spoken to Roman about this in a while, so I'm not sure what the status of that approach is. And some of the folks, you know, as I'm sure you heard before, that respond to very brief dose interruption and or dose attenuation, and the rash, of course, tends to improve over time anyway. Probably if we did nothing, 80% of patients would be able to tolerate it by the end of a month anyway.
What would be the pathophysiology of why vitamin K would work?
Yeah, I have not followed that field that closely.
Let's talk a little bit about the new ECOG trial that's going to try to evaluate bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting. Clearly, that whole question of adjuvant bevacizumab has a lot of interest. Colon cancer, it's the major question. Breast cancer, now those trials are being designed. Where are we in lung cancer?
Well, I think that the presentation of the adjuvant CALGB data for the 1B patients this year has created some consternation and rethinking of exactly how the ECOG 1505 should be crafted. That's the adjuvant trial. Putting that aside, and that's really a question of the merits of a particular chemo regimen, I think it's a vitally important question. I've mentioned previously that most things that work pretty well in metastatic or lead to improvements add that much more in the local regional setting in most cancers. And so here's a regimen where you more than doubled response rate. You were one of the first three-drug versus two-drug combination trials to be successful. And so I think my gut would be that 5 years from now, or whenever we know the results of this study, 6 or 7 years, that we would have a positive trial. So that being said, I think that the plan would be for 2 or 3 cisplatin-based doublets and hopefully an international trial to facilitate accrual. It's really incumbent on this to get this done in a more timely fashion because we have been slow in getting these adjuvant trials done. And people sometimes have a certain nihilism in lung cancer to find reasons not to do something rather than find reasons to do something. I mean, a 2% improvement in survival in breast cancer is a big deal, but in lung cancer, we haven't been as rabid about pursuing those modest benefits.
You mentioned your openness to erlotinib in the adjuvant setting, which is, you know, controversial for sure, and I think probably a lot of people won't do that. But in the non-smoker or mutation patient, what about off-protocol bevacizumab in the adjuvant setting? Young patient, well-read, brings in a stack of papers from the internet. Would you consider doing that?
I haven't done it to date. I think I would be willing to have a discussion about it with the patient, you know, if they wanted to. They had a really high-risk tumor, and they were young and completed their adjuvant therapy and wanted to, you know, follow, say, one of the arms designed for the ECOG 1505, sort of run in parallel to do it. I suspect I could have my arm twisted to do that in a certain clinical setting.
Where are we in terms of information on toxicity of bevacizumab, and how do you think that's going to play out in the adjuvant setting?
So I think that the adjuvant therapy, of course, is harder to deliver in lung cancer than in other diseases for a variety of reasons, and that the toxicities of bevacizumab or the synergistic toxicities with chemo are not trivial. Nonetheless, they are in general outweighed by the survival benefits we see. I think the risk of febrile neutropenia is clearly enhanced. The risk of grade 4 neutropenia is clearly enhanced.
Can you talk about those numbers?
So in 4599, the most recent review of the data shows about a 5% incidence of febrile neutropenia with the combination of bevacizumab added to carbopaclitaxel as opposed to about 1% for the chemotherapy alone. There were also about 15 deaths potentially attributed to bevacizumab-based combination versus only about 0.5% in the control arm of chemotherapy alone. So those differences are potentially significant, and I think that when one has a discussion about bevacizumab with a patient, they need to explain that there's about a 1% risk of fatal hemoptysis. There is an increased risk of heart attack and stroke. But nonetheless, at the end of a year, there's more people standing who had the bevacizumab. And at the end of 2 years, there's more people standing who have the bevacizumab.
Any way to predict whether or not a patient would be at risk for bleeding with, you know, no evidence of disease?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know of, other than the obvious things, whether they want anticoagulation or had some bleeding diathesis or known factor deficiency. I don't know of anything, unless you had something particularly unusual about their surgery, that would predict for bleeding in the adjuvant setting. And certainly I would expect substantial bleeding to be less in that setting.
Are you part of the camp that believes that these bleeds are probably manifestations of tumor response?
I'm not sure. I think I personally believe the bleeds are probably somehow related to a histologic type of lung cancer rather than necessarily where they're anatomically located or the response per se. I mean, there's data, at least anecdotally discussed, that they're, and I haven't reviewed this myself, or I don't know that it's necessarily been published, but that bevacizumab can be given quite safely in small cell lung cancer. Well, that's a very chemo-responsive tumor. So you're giving a drug probably with chemo that's quite active, and you're seeing a lot of shrinkages, and yet you don't see bleeding. So I think it's probably a biology difference between, say, a squamous cell tumor and a small cell tumor, both of which are centrally located, both of which can be endobronchial, both of which can change rapidly, rather than a location issue.
You mentioned the CALGB trial that was updated at the ASCO meeting. Can you kind of go through what was reported and what the implications and controversy that's come out of that?
So in stage 1B non-small cell lung cancer, this was a trial of adjuvant carboplatin and paclitaxel versus observation after one surgery. And 2 years ago, it was shown at a median follow-up of either 3 or 4 years to have a 15% improvement in median survival, which had a very statistically significant p-value. But there are some who appropriately caution that the follow-up was not quite as mature as what had been reported for other adjuvant therapies, say the BR-10 Canadian trial of cisplatin and vinorelbine. This year, we saw an update of that data, and although the survival was clearly still in favor of the group that got adjuvant chemotherapy, the p-value was no longer significant for overall survival, although the disease-free survival and the 3-year survival and I believe the 4-year survival did have statistically significant p-values. So the question's arisen really, is this a stage-specific phenomenon, a treatment-specific phenomenon, and what should be done both with this stage of disease and this regimen in other adjuvant trials?
And I guess the progression-free survival, though, continued to be favorable. Is that correct?
Yes.
What do we know about, and this certainly comes up in other tumors, breast cancer, colon cancer, or, you know, FOLFOX doesn't have survival data right now, about disease-free survival and adjuvant lung cancer predicting survival?
My overall feeling would be that would probably intuitively be a good predictor of overall survival, but I'm not aware that we have data that's been presented in that fashion for any of the prior trials in this setting.
What do you think is going on in terms of this trial, in terms of the explanation of these data?
This trial was hard to accrue to, again, for whatever reason, and so the trial was amended to allow a small number of patients, and because the accrual was slow, you had more time to sort of study each event and data point. But I think it doesn't necessarily change my feeling about the overall trial or my practice. I mean, there's always been more ambiguity as to how much the 1Bs were benefiting as opposed to the 2s and 3s, and it makes sense that in the worst stage disease, your magnitude of benefit, your relative increase in outcome will be better for adjuvant therapy. So in stage 2 and 3, I think everyone clearly will want to recommend adjuvant therapy in the resected patient. In 1A, I don't think there's any data to suggest adjuvant therapy, and in 1B, it's worth a discussion.
You know, looking at the models that have evolved out of breast and colon cancer, you might be tempted to say it's, quote, an events thing. You know, there in the other tumors, we believe there's a relative risk reduction. It's just harder to, you know, document what's going on in the lower risk patient. Is that the way you see this?
I think that one needs to do a very large trial in 1Bs with a cisplatin-based regimen so that that takes the variable of the carboplatin out and see what we get.
So it sounds like you have concerns in terms of carbo in the adjuvant setting.
I think the bulk of, if not all the data now, is for cisplatin-based therapy. And there's innumerable studies that suggest, either individual studies or meta-analyses, that cisplatin-based therapy is clearly related with a higher response rate, relatively lower risk of death than carboplatin-based therapy. And while that may be mitigated by toxicity in the advanced stage patient, in the early stage patient, I think we're incumbent to use what gives the greatest chance of cure.
So perhaps you can discuss your non-protocol management or discussions with patients with 1A disease, 1B, and 2 in terms of whether or not you bring up or offer adjuvant therapy and specifically what type.
So for 1A patients, I would not have the discussion. I would tell them what the cure rate is so that they're not misled thinking it's a 90% deal. Tell them that, you know, somewhere between a 25 and 35% chance of recurrence depending on their specific stage within 1A or specific T size and so forth. For 1B patients, I would explain that it's somewhat a contentious area, that there are several trials that included patients with their stage of disease that did suggest a benefit for the overall group. And there's one trial specifically looking at their stage of disease that used a slightly different chemotherapy that suggested a trend but did not attain what we call statistical significance.
And if they want to receive therapy, which regimen would you generally use?
I would use a cisplatin-based regimen. I would use one of the ones in a trial that showed that benefit or something that's known to be equivalent to it. So I would either use cisplatin and vinorelbine, or I think we're all comfortable from advanced disease that cisplatin and docetaxel is at least as good, if not better. And so I think that would be a reasonable surrogate. I would not use carboplatin in that setting.
Stage two?
Stage two, I would push harder for the individual to get the chemotherapy. I think there's far less debate as to whether there's benefit to adjuvant therapy in that setting. And I would use the same cisplatin-based doublet, either with vinorelbine or docetaxel.
What are you observing in your practice as you give adjuvant therapy? And this is a new thing, really, basically, in terms of how people tolerate it and your ability to predict who's going to tolerate it well and who's going to have problems.
Well, that's an interesting thing, that a number of the trials are written that an individual needs to start adjuvant therapy within X weeks of surgery. But the question is that something biologic about the tumor, or the individuals who are not able to start until 9 or 10 weeks, you're just selecting for relative, you know, poor performance status or comorbid conditions where there or even early relapse. So we generally try to stick within starting the individual within 8 weeks or so of their surgery. And I think that their, you know, baseline performance status as they start and comorbid conditions are probably the best predictors of how they're going to do with things. And I think some of the regimens are a little easier than others. Cisplatin, vinorelbine for 16 weeks, you know, that's a big commitment for a lung cancer patient. They're not used to hearing that, or at least maybe it's a more big commitment for the docs because we're not used to doing it, you know. But it is, I think, by the calculations from the YALT trial, you know, saving 7,000 lives a year. So we need to suck it up and help the patients get through it.
What about in the otherwise healthy, perfectly good performance status, older patient, particularly in their 70s?
I think that one can certainly use these regimens, assuming their, you know, calculated creatinine clearance is going to be lower than the person with the same serum creatinine who's half that age. So I think if they meet the other criteria for eligibility, you know, they don't have comorbidities which exclude treatment, that one can use a cisplatin-based regimen. I mean, there are things that become more common as one ages. They're more likely to have hearing loss. They're more likely to have neuropathy from maybe diabetes or other conditions. So there may be more contraindications to getting the platinum in this setting. But some of this we're going to have to learn as we go. There isn't a big database yet on patients who are 70, much less 80, who get adjuvant chemotherapy with cisplatin.
I want to flip back to metastatic disease. You were talking before about your approach to patients in the enriched population. I'd like to explore a little bit more about your first, second, and third line therapies in general in the patients who aren't enriched.
I think if I had a sort of run-of-the-mill smoker squamous cell carcinoma, I would use, most likely, if they were highly symptomatic, I might incorporate cisplatin because I think you get a little bit more rapidity of symptomatic response. But if they had, you know, sort of average symptom level for lung cancer patients, I tend to use carboplatin with either gemcitabine or paclitaxel.
Second line?
And then depending, again, on their, say, if they're not someone in whom you prioritize them for an EGFR TKI, I would then look to pemetrexed. I like the drug. I think you get less alopecia, less febrile neutropenia, and it's pretty well tolerated. Ease of administration every 3 weeks. Patients love taking vitamins. So I think that's a pretty easy drug for the second line setting.
Third line?
Then, of course, patients who get third and fourth line therapy are more likely to be those who have a better natural history, so you're more likely to enrich for the EGFR TKI population. But if that's not the case, or someone whom I thought EGFR TKI were just terribly unlikely to work, then I might look at gemcitabine, weekly docetaxel. Those would be the options, and you could certainly consider erlotinib at some point in the paradigm.
Same questions, first, second, and third line therapy, if you get there, in the PS2 patient.
Yeah, PS2 patient, I tend to be moved by that, whether their condition is due more to comorbid illness or due to their disease. Because if I see someone who has terrible COPD, peripheral neuropathy from diabetes, and has stage 4 disease but is relatively asymptomatic, I explain to them that even if I give you the most effective chemo possible, I'm not going to make your life a whole hell of a lot better. You're going to feel the same, and you might live longer. So in that patient, where most of what you're seeing is being driven by their other illnesses, I tend to use monotherapy.
What about erlotinib in those patients?
If they fit the profile of someone who might benefit from erlotinib, I would use it. But if they were, say, a heavy smoker, 60-pack years, and they had a known KRAS mutation, or I thought they were unlikely to be a real good response to erlotinib, I would probably start with something like pemetrexed or gemcitabine or weekly docetaxel.
What about the patient who's gotten carbo, taxol, and bev, now is deteriorated, performance status 2, presenting for second-line therapy?
PS2 patient, if they fit the profile of a TKI, this would be a perfect patient for erlotinib. If we were sort of ambivalent as to whether they were likely to benefit from the TKI, but their performance status was marginal, you could consider that or pemetrexed.
What are some of the clinical research questions in lung cancer right now? And obviously, the issue of TKIs is something that you've been very involved with. But just sort of looking at the whole spectrum of clinical research in lung cancer, what are some of the questions and directions that you think are going to be most fruitful in the next few years?
Well, I think that the articles in the New England Journal a few weeks ago on dasatinib and nilotinib in CML and the accompanying editorial were very instructive. And from an industry standpoint, they were, I thought, illustrative that the imatinib has become a $2 billion drug. So one of the things that I think is nice and that maybe we can partner with industry on is that it's okay to study and develop drugs in sort of these boutique or designer indications, especially when you look at like lung cancer, a disease like lung cancer, where 10% of that big pie is still a heck of a lot of number of patients. And if we can increase the so-called area under the curve, i.e. the length of time for which that 10% of patients is on drug X, by making drug X better or defining the molecular profile, we will clearly help the patients and also have, you know, enthusiastic partners in industry. So one thing that I would like to do specifically in sort of our area of research is to do better with the EGFR TKIs. And specifically, that would be either develop better TKIs, TKIs that are better in one mutation than the other, because we know that the point mutation, the exon 21 point mutation patients do less well. That may not be that that's a more virulent mutation. It may just be that our available drugs aren't as good for it as they are for the exon 19 deletion. Similarly, if we can, by partnering, say, erlotinib with a second drug in those patients, if we can have their median time to progression in that sensitive population be 2 or 3 years as opposed to 1 year, everybody's going to be a heck of a lot happier. And there are leads on how that might occur, either augmenting, combining them with chemo or with other biologics like immunotherapy. So that's one area that we're particularly interested in. And I think you even see that theme, though, with the cytotoxics, that people now really think that we can use some molecular tests as guides for, as predictive markers of benefit from a certain chemo. So the ERCC story, cisplatin repair surrogate, that high levels of that marker predict for lack of benefit from adjuvant cisplatin therapy, RRM1, ribonucleotide reductase M1 subunit, high levels of that predict for lack of benefit from gemcitabine. So these are now getting more legs and may allow us, at least somewhat loosely, to put patients into certain bins for more effective therapies.
What about the VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitors and specifically ZD6474 or Zactima, where there was some data presented at ASCO?
Well, I thought this year at ASCO was good because although we didn't have the blockbuster phase 3 study, we had a lot of phase 2 studies that were interesting. So we saw our first data on sunitinib and sorafenib in lung cancer, not just one or two patients from a phase 1 trial, but dedicated phase 2 studies. We saw two studies with 6474. So I think that Zactima is an interesting drug. I like the concept that it may capture the most sensitive patients for its EGFR effects and yet may have more predominantly a VEGF effect. and therefore may not counteract or have negative interactions with chemo in most patients with non-small cell lung cancer.
What about those data, particularly what was presented at ASCO in terms of sunitinib, sorafenib, and Zactima?
I think one of the most challenging questions is, how does one know whether a anti-angiogenic drug, and of course that's a broad category, is going to be clinically useful in lung cancer based on monotherapy trials? If you look at the prototype bevacizumab, although it hasn't been formally studied, at least anecdotally, there weren't great results seen in phase one trials of patients with lung cancer who got this drug. So what signal can we get from early trials of sorafenib or sunitinib that they might be as good, if not better, than, say, bevacizumab? And so to me, certainly the sunitinib trial, we saw a 10% response rate in pretreated patients, was pretty impressive. It was concerning, of course, that there were three deaths, and one question was, are they going to modify their eligibility for subsequent trials based on that? Are they going to make them more like bevacizumab trials? Because I think two patients were squamous, or one was squamous and one had a brain met. So it did sound like a familiar story. Yet that 10% response rate, and perhaps even more importantly, that waterfall plot, where 70 or 80% of patients were on the right side of the x-axis, was really quite impressive to me. Now, sorafenib is a little bit less. The IC50s are a little bit higher for some of the kinases, and in the trial presented by Dr. Gatzmeier, there were no formal responses, although certainly there was some evidence of biologic effect. There were some patients whose tumors cavitated, but the waterfall plot, where you sort of look at everybody's maximal benefit from chemo, was a little bit less impressive. So of the two, I actually was a little more impressed with the sunitinib, and I thought certainly the fact that we saw a reproducible number of partial responses, not one or two, but 10%, you know, not dissimilar from what we saw with some cytotoxics in phase two trials in pretreated patients, raised hope that this would have a role in lung cancer at some point in the future.
What about the responses and the clinical data for Zactima?
I think that the Zactima data in the crossover trial with gefitinib were a little disappointing for the gefitinib, that we saw a lower response rate than we're used to seeing. The 9% or so response rate for the ZD6474 is right in line with what you'd expect with monotherapy with an EGFR TKI or a VEGF tyrosine kinase inhibitor.
So what was the design of that study?
That was a crossover. You started on one drug and crossed to the other at progression. And the individuals who started with gefitinib actually had, I believe, a little bit longer median survival, I think 7.4 versus 6.1 months, but they had the gefitinib-treated patients had fewer responses. And I actually believe when you looked at all the prognostic data, and I pointed this out to Ron Natale at ASCO, that there were some imbalances in the prognostic factors that were actually in favor of the group that got gefitinib first, i.e. that I thought the Zactima probably looked better in the study. The deck was stacked against the Zactima patients a little bit as far as patient characteristics.
So in terms of actual response rates, the Zactima
was a higher response rate.
Do you think we're going to see more studies in lung cancer focusing on tissue, molecular predictors? And are we going to be able to pull these kinds of studies off in people presenting with metastatic disease? Roy Herbst and Ed Kim have an interesting study where they're doing pre- and post-biopsies with biologic agents on board, including erlotinib. Do you think that's a trend that's going to increase? And is that practical?
I think it's incumbent on us in the academic community to come up with hypotheses and or data that are so provocative that everybody will jump through hoops and move mountains to make things happen to show that that's improving the outcome of the lung cancer patient. So like an EGFR mutation test now, we know we have a response rate of 70 or 80%. That's unparalleled in lung cancer history, so people will want that information.
Do you think we're going to see more studies, you know, doing pre- and post-biopsies in the metastatic setting?
I think certainly at the academic institutions that do research, and then when we find out something that can be translated to the lung cancer patient in the community, then if that's what's necessary for that community venue to be successful and treat their patients successfully, then it will happen there.